In the extraordinary circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic, TNI and its allies are working to continue to bring you radical analysis of the most pressing issues of the day. Join us for our weekly webinars. We bring together excellent experts to discuss how this pandemic health crisis exposes the injustices of the global economic order and how this crisis must be a turning point towards creating the systems, structures, and policies that can always protect those who are marginalized and allow people to live with dignity. The following is a recording of a webinar where panelists tackle the question of how we can ensure that the economic response to COVID-19 also addresses existing crises, most of all, the unfolding climate crisis. How do we build a truly global Green New Deal that delivers transformation and justice, especially in the Global South? This webinar features leading international activists and thinkers bringing fresh new perspectives on how to embed just transition into our response to the coronavirus pandemic.
Hi, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. Wonderful that you're all joining us for our weekly webinar series. My name is Fiona Dove, and I'm the director of the Transnational Institute. I'm from South Africa, but I live in the Netherlands. For those who don't know us, TNI is an international activist think tank, and we try to act as a unique nexus between activist scholars and movements for transformative change and social justice. We regularly publish new research and organize events to develop collective analyses of political moments and to support the social movements at the front lines of struggles for social and environmental justice. So in this very particular political moment, we've been hosting the series of weekly Wednesday webinars to address different dimensions of the current crisis. You can subscribe to our newsletter if you want updates on these, forthcoming ones and the ones that have just passed. And if you've missed any of the past ones, you can always go to our YouTube channel to check them out there. I'm very pleased to say that this webinar is also being translated into French and Spanish. So I want to say a really big thank you to our wonderful team of interpreters. Emily, David, Monica, and Maxime. You can listen to the interpretation by clicking on the bottom bar of your window and selecting the language that you want. We're also really grateful to our co-sponsoring organizations for their idea, their inputs, and for promoting each webinar. Today, our co-sponsors are focused on the Global South and AIDC, the Alternative Information and Development Center in South Africa. Both Focus and AIDC have been co-sponsoring this whole series. Today we have three additional sponsors, and that's the Institute of Political Ecology in Croatia, Transform Europe, and the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. This week we're going to be looking at both the challenges and the opportunities that this pandemic poses for addressing even bigger climate crisis. Some of today's conversation will build on our second webinar, in which Jayati Ghosh and Walden Bellow and others shared what actions are needed to address the economic fallout. I'm very excited about our speakers today, who will continue that conversation and who are generously sharing their time with us. Just to introduce them quickly, and I will introduce them in more detail as they speak. We have Richard Kozel Wright from the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD. We have Karen Nunson, who is the chairperson of Friends of the Earth International and a founding member of Redes, Friends of the Earth Uruguay. We have Sandra Fenikirk, who is a researcher with the 1 Million Climate Jobs Campaign and associated with AIDC. And we were to have had Asad Rehman, director of War and Want in the UK and co-organizer of the Global Green New Deal campaign, but we just got message that Asad had to go to hospital because he was unwell. So we've heard that Asad is okay, but he's got to rest up. But we're really sorry that he won't be able to join us. For the format today, we're going to start with a presentation by Richard Kurzelwright, and then we'll have two rounds of conversation with other panelists before opening up to questions from everyone. You can share your questions throughout the session via the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen. And throughout the session, we'll be sharing links to resources and further reading in the chat box, which you can see also at the bottom of your screen. And you can also engage with each other there. And finally, if you're on Twitter or other social media, we're also using the hashtag TNI webinars. So feel free to share your thoughts and reflections with us there as well. Before we begin, I would like to discuss quickly the term Green New Deal. So just to say that we're using the term Green New Deal as a kind of shorthand. And it's for talking about a program of action that addresses the climate crisis on the scale that it demands and ensuring that those affected by climate change are at the heart of any solutions. We're conscious, of course, that the term Green New Deal is very much a framing that has most resonance in the United States and Europe. And there are many other frames and ideas for describing the same kind of systemic policy changes that we need, from just transition to buen vivir, to degrowth, to deglobalization. So I wanted to start with a very quick 1 minute round, asking each of our panelists to answer briefly, what does Green New Deal mean to you? Just so we can clarify right at the beginning what it is we mean by that concept. Richard, can we start with you?
Thank you very much, Fiona. Thank you for the invitation. To answer, let me take you back a decade. 2009, I was at the UN in New York. I was in charge of the World Economic and Social Survey, working on the Climate and Development Challenge in readiness for COP15. And as we were finishing that report, colleagues from UNEP, the United Nations Environmental Programme, gave a presentation of their report called A Global Green New Deal, which was obviously had the similar intent to what we were doing. Now, for me, I'm not coming from an environmental background. I do have a historical background. And for me, the old New Deal was always about the contestation of economic power. It was about regulating Wall Street. It was about the Public Works Administration and the expansion of the public sector. It was about the Tennessee Valley Authority, about the Wagner Act, etc. This wasn't, as when I listened to my colleagues at UNEP, what they understood by the New Deal. They were talking about the need to bring in private finance to deliver public goods. They were talking about public-private partnerships. They were talking about corporate social responsibility. So when we finished our report, I thought I needed to impose a somewhat different notion of a Green New Deal to what we were arguing for, and particularly the influence of the idea of a Marshall Plan, which I consider to be an international extension of the old New Deal. And we wrote a report and the conclusions of our report around that idea. We went to present the report to Ban Ki-moon as the UNSG, as we are obliged to do. And it seemed like good timing to do that. If you remember, the slogan for Copenhagen was "Seal the Deal," was the slogan. And of course, at the same time, the G20 were struggling with the aftermath of the global financial crisis and were talking about a new Bretton Woods that would be put into place to prevent that happening again. To cut a long story short, when we went to see Ban Ki-moon, he had very little interest in the intricacies of the international monetary system. He wanted a song for Copenhagen. I remember that. That was important for him. But he was not interested in the intricacies of our argument. And as you know, Copenhagen fell apart as developing countries came to the realization that they were going to be asked to carry the can for actions taken by the wealthiest parts of the world. And soon after that, the G20, having basically saved their own banks, shifted gear, looked to austerity as a way of getting back to business as usual. And I guess the lesson I took from that is if we're going to avoid the threat of an environmental and economic death spiral, we have to position the idea of a global New Deal in relationship and against the rules, practices, and policies of this hyper-globalized world that gave us a financial crisis and was undermining the environment. So that essentially is how I take the Global Green New Deal to be about.
Great. Thanks, Richard. Karen, you want to come in?
Thank you, Fiona, and also to TNI for the invitation. As Friends of the Earth International, we don't have a position yet on whether to use the framing of the Green New Deal to advance our system change agenda. We do have a system change agenda that is aimed at tackling root causes of the profound systemic social ecological crisis we face, the climate, biodiversity, food, economic crisis, and now the pandemic, are the result of a system that gives priority to corporate power and profits over people's rights and the environment. Our system change agenda also calls to tackle and to dismantle the systems of oppressions that are at the roots, are structural to the system of capital accumulation. And it also demands that we reclaim politics, we reclaim the public sphere, we make sure that the democratization of our societies goes forward and we find ways for much more profound democracy that allows for real people's participation, for us to reclaim control over our food system, our economy system, energy system, and so on. So it does demand the strengthening of the public sphere. And in that sense, there are a lot of commonalities with what Richard was describing just now.
Thanks, Karen. Sandra?
Yeah, like Karen, we haven't finalized kind of what we are terming our vision for a new future. Largely, we're not comfortable with the name of a new Green Deal. And I think that is partly because it has connotations of greening the economy, green jobs, which I think has been hijacked, you know, in the climate change discourse, has largely been hijacked by big capital to mean sort of putting a veneer of environmentally friendly services and products, but is really just a way of increasing profits. So it's got that kind of connotation for us of something that is about ameliorating the worst aspects of capitalism rather than radical change. But whatever we choose to call it, I think for us, what it means or what we hope that we can get to is a vision of a radical restructuring of the economy that is really focused on meeting basic needs in a way that doesn't super exploit nature in the way that capitalism has been doing up to now. And even beyond that, ensures that everybody is able to live a decent and meaningful life with decent jobs. And I think we're very strong on the issue of jobs must be decent. Like Karen, there's a strong emphasis on the public sector and the role of the public sector in doing this, in creating jobs, in driving a radical change to the economy. So what we're seeing it involving is potentially increased production and services, because we have so many people in South Africa and in the South who lack services, who lack basic goods. But certainly it's going to mean radical redistribution to reduce vast inequalities. So it's not going to be just about ensuring that, poverty is alleviated, but that there's radical redistribution in order to ensure a more equitable society. And then I think just focusing on the global aspect of the term Global New Green Deal, for us, it's about building movements for change in the different countries that are able to then act in solidarity with each other on a global scale for a different future. We hope that we can envisage such a different future that does better for us than capitalism has.
Thank you, Sandra. So hopefully for everyone that clarifies where we're coming from in using this shorthand. No, to make the case for the Global Green New Deal, I'm going to give the floor to Richard, but first maybe to introduce him. So Richard Kozel-Wright is a senior economist, and he's director of the Division on Globalization and Development, Development Strategies at the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD. He's edited many volumes on transnational corporations in the global economy, economic insecurity and development, climate protection and development, and industrial policy. And he's the author, most recently, of Transforming Economies, Making Industrial Policy Work for Growth, Jobs, and Development, which the ILO published in 2014. So I'm going to hand now to Richard to make the case for a global Green New Deal in the wake of the coronavirus.
Even before COVID hit, the economic prospects again across the world economy were deteriorating against this backdrop of interlinked and mutually reinforcing economic, social, and environmental stresses and crises. And as I said before, solving these crises needs to address the rules of this hyper-globalized world that has emerged over the last three or four decades, and the vested interests that have formulated those rules, particularly around footloose finance. And effective solutions, as both Karen and Sandra have emphasized, require that the public sector take the lead in finding solutions to these stresses with sufficient resources and adequate policy space to deal effectively with them. And this means, at least for us, it means a transformative agenda. You can't solve these problems incrementally if you're going to escape this so-called new normal that has emerged even more strongly since 2009. And we think the idea of a Green New Deal can provide that kind of unifying narrative and a set of policy proposals to address not only the immediate problems of global recession, but to mitigate the systemic stresses and to affect the required transformation. And when you look at the kind of packages that are bundled together under the rubric of the Green New Deal, and mainly in the North, it has to be said, but not only, they have certain common elements. However, they reject austerity, first of all, and they look for kind of macroeconomic measures that are wage-led and job-rich. They involve always a massive investment push into climate mitigation and adaptation, but I think beyond that to notions of the care economy that are intimately linked with the need to address and build a healthier population and a healthier planet. They always involve progressive taxation, the need for progressive taxation systems. They always involve regulating finance and a much bigger role for public banking as central to a different type of financial system. And they involve some kind of strategic planning, including a central role for industrial policy. All these are the kind of elements you find under the rubric, I think, of a global Green New Deal. Now, whilst most of these measures are rooted in the national state, there's a strong state-centered argument and therefore a national argument to these Green New Deals, I think they all also point beyond the national level. And that's particularly true, of course, when it comes to developing countries and pulling up the people of the South and cooling down the planet, I think shifts the Green New Deal narrative to a global level, and in the process calls on the multilateral system to provide a robust framework for policy coordination, resource mobilization, and regulatory oversight. And I guess in the work that we've tried to do in UNCTAD, in the Trade and Development Report in particular, has been to show why the economic stresses that have characterized this world of hyper-globalization, rising inequality, insecurity, indebtedness, are a product of the rules of hyper-globalization, and they're very much reinforcing of each other. But I think what we've also tried to do is to highlight a big paradox around those rules, and I think an opportunity for progressives everywhere, which is, despite being avowedly pro-business, which the rules of neoliberalism and hyper-globalization certainly are, they have failed to boost productive investment. And that's both true of the private sector, and it's true particularly, of course, of the public sector. So that emphasis on the need for a strong role for investment is central to our understanding of the opportunities around the global Green New Deal. Now, the question, I guess, how has COVID impacted on this discussion? I think, and obviously, it has forced governments in the advanced economies to tear up the neoliberal rule book, first of all, when you know, Tory chancellors suddenly discover their inner Keynesian self, and Steve Mnuchin becomes a kind of implicit advocate of basic income, then you've changed your understanding of the kinds of policies that you need to pursue to address this problem. And beyond that, I think they've thrown a wedge between the ideas of what is needed for a healthy population and a healthy planet, and we know from COVID that these two things are closely related, and the idea of what constitutes a healthy economy. And I think the big question now is, how are we going to reconnect healthy people, healthy planet, and a healthy economy? And in a certain sense, the global financial crisis was a dry run for this, for the neoliberal tradition. The response to the 2009 crisis. I'm losing my notes here. Was about getting back to business as usual. The great moderation was the metric against which these people measured their policy goals, and supporting footloose capital and ensuring that it could make profits whenever, wherever, and however it wanted was essentially the basis for the policy initiatives that came out of the 2009 crisis. Of course, with a little bit of help from the gargantuan expansion of central bank asset sheets, and with a huge piling up of debt, public, private, developed, and developing countries. Now, I think the COVID-19 has dramatically exposed the limits of that kind of agenda and the fragility of the runaway hyperglobalized world that we have been subject to. And it's provided a dramatic reminder, I think, that the health of people and the planet rests on this provision of public goods and the protection of the global commons. And the global Green New Deal, I think, offers an alternative way of reconnecting people, the economy, and the planet around this idea of a massive investment push led by the public sector. Now, the estimates of what is involved in terms of financing vary tremendously, but everyone acknowledges that it requires moving from billions of dollars a year to trillions of dollars a year, to borrow a phrase from the World Bank. We think it's in the order of 2-3% of global GDP annually that is required over the next decade, with a significant amount of that obviously going to the developing world. And of course, the first reaction you get to these kinds of numbers is, you know, can we afford this? Is the financing available? And again, the COVID-19 crisis to some extent helps in this regard, because, you know, the response to the Keynesians after 2009 was that, well, we don't have the kind of magic money trees that you need to be able to fund an expansionary response. What we see now is not simply magic money trees, but the whole emergence of magic money forests that have somehow magically concocted trillions of dollars to deal with the consequences and offset the problems that have emerged from this crisis. So the issue of financial resources, at least to us, seems to be somewhat of a red herring. And when you look at the mechanisms of credit creation, the opportunities for taxation, the reshifting of government programs from what is unproductive to what could be potentially productive, the resources are undoubtedly out there. And people like Naomi Klein in This Changes Everything have gone through a particular combination of taxes and subsidies that could be shifted into a Green New Deal agenda. Bob Pollin, from the University of Massachusetts, has done the same. Bob has a bigger role for the credit system, as do we in UNCTAD, in defining the potential resources to fund this kind of large-scale investment drive. And the 2019 Trade and Development Report tried to set out the kinds of resources that we think need to be rechanneled into a global Green New Deal that are available to meet the investments in climate, not simply in climate mitigation and adaptation, but in the provision of public goods more generally. And we tried to show in our modeling of that exercise why that kind of agenda is not only good in terms of increasing demand, of providing new jobs, of increasing wages, but also it does open the opportunities to reduce carbon emissions to ensure that the health of the planet is deliverable within a reasonable time frame. It's not a blueprint in the 2019 Trade Development Report. It's a reminder of the economic linkages that need to be utilized to ensure that this kind of policy is credible from a kind of economic point of view. That said, the Wall Street consensus hasn't gone away. And it hasn't gone away in particular in the international monetary system and indeed in the wider Bretton Woods multilateral system. And that's a problem particularly for developing countries where the resource constraint is much more binding still than it is in the advanced economies. And sadly, compared with what they were meant to do, the Bretton Woods institutions, which was to control footloose capital, that's what they were set up to do, they have, over the last 30 years, become handmaidens, essentially, of a very speculative and predatory form of capital that works against the kind of agenda that I've tried to outline. So that's an obvious problem for people like ourselves, because we want to we don't think you can simply trash that system overnight. You have to find ways of reforming that system in ways that can deliver on the kind of agenda that we're talking about. Although that reform, we think, will also involve new institutions that can deliver more investment, more stability, more fairness, and a healthier planet, including, for the developing world. And we've tried to outline a set of principles for delivering shared and sustainable prosperity, work that we've done with Kevin Gallagher and his team at Boston University, what we call the Geneva Principles for a Global Green New Deal that could provide this alternative. And we've tried to outline reforms of the international financial system that we think would be necessary to support this kind of agenda. And let me just finish by very quickly saying what we see as key reforms in this agenda. The first one, of course, is the need for developing countries to have sufficient policy space to be able to enact the kinds of policies that we see as part of a Green New Deal. That means revising free trade agreements. It means revising bilateral investment treaties, because these have very significantly cut into the policy space of developing countries. It means revisiting the need for capital controls as a necessary part of the toolkit of developing countries. The IMF has been ambiguous on that, although it's moved in that direction in recent years. We need to clamp down on corporate tax evasion and illicit financial flows, going beyond the OECD BEPS initiative towards a common unitary taxation system with a global minimum tax rate. I think we need to talk about a global competition authority that can deal with the restrictive business practices of very large corporations. That's an idea we've thrown out in UNCTAD in the past. We need a debt jubilee. I think Jayati Ghosh talked about this in her presentation a couple of weeks ago. That's long-standing UNCTAD demand, the need for a proper international system to deal with sovereign debt restructuring. It goes back to the 1980s. We've long argued that that is a missing part of the Bretton Woods jigsaw. I think we need a properly funded global climate bank. Although the IMF and the World Bank have a role, I don't think they should be given sole responsibility to that. Funding that kind of bank is an important issue. Weaning it from the dependence on credit rating agencies as a source of their risk management is critical. And we've also talked about, as I said before, the need for a green Marshall Plan that will deal properly with issues of technology transfer and adaptation funds for developing countries with different funding mechanisms, using SDRs, possibly ODA, in a different kind of way. So that's the kind of architectural reforms that we want to see. And just to go back to what was said about the use of the New Deal at the beginning by Karen and Sandra, You know, a New Deal, at least for me, implies an avowedly political project. I think that was true of the original New Deal. It was responding to the anxieties of the times in the United States with a transformative agenda. That's what the New Deal was all about. It acknowledged that there were vested interests that had to be confronted, and it embraced popular voices in a way that had not been true of American politics, certainly before that. And it took policy details very seriously. And it's those combinations, I think, that make the idea of a New Deal, and in this case, a global Green New Deal, a relevant framing of the agenda that we're talking about.
Great. Thank you very much, Richard. That was really very rich. Lots of activity on the chat around these issues. Karen and Sandra are now going to be given an opportunity to reflect on Richard's input, but also reflect more generally on the perspective on a global Green New Deal from their own locations. We're going to start with Karen. Karen's been the chairperson of Friends of the Earth International since 2016. FOEI is the world's largest grassroots environmental federation. She's an environmental justice activist from Uruguay. She's got a diploma in family farming. Karen's worked with peasant movements across Latin America advocating for food sovereignty and agroecological diverse and just food systems. And she was a founding member, as I mentioned earlier, of Friends of the Earth Uruguay, Redes, in 1988. Karen, you work with people and movements who risk their lives to defend the environment and livelihoods, and who are also on the front line of climate change impacts, and presumably also now on the front line of the COVID-19 impact. What, in your opinion, is needed for a truly just and systemic transformation?
Thank you, Fiona, and also to Richard for his inputs. So for us in Friends of the Earth, one of the things that is very clear after this crisis is that the impacts are, you know, go well beyond the dramatic, tragic loss of human lives, and it's related to the imposition of a neoliberal logic in our societies and the system of capital accumulation in our societies. So what it is clear once again, and that was being said by social movements for so long already, is that neoliberalism doesn't work for people and the environment. It doesn't allow to save lives. On the contrary, it really threatens our health, it threatens our well-being, and it drastically reduces the policy space that are desperately needed for addressing and tackling this and other crises. So the centrality of the sustainability of life is once again very clear, as well as the importance, the vital importance of justice, gender justice, social justice, environmental justice, economic justice, and also people's sovereignty. And this means that we radically need to change a current system. We need a radical transformation of our societies and our living systems and how we organize ourselves. And this demands a lot of participation and a more profound democracy that allows us to make those changes. But having said that, it is also true that the current pandemic is taking place in a context in which democracy was also under attack, with very dramatic consequences in many countries where human rights, environmental rights defenders are being persecuted, are being even murdered throughout the world. And transnational companies are gaining more and more power and controlling our systems and controlling our economies, but also even intervening in coup d'etats, for example, in the case of Latin America. But also imposing the rules that are totally against people's rights and the environment. So democracy is really something that we need to defend and we need to reclaim in order to be able to face these challenges and in order to change current situations. Also, it became very important, the paramount importance of care work, which means that we need to put an end to the sexual division of labor. This is very key. And also the importance of public services, social security systems, health services, and so on. So it means that we really need to put a lot of emphasis on the public goods that we need to realize our rights. As Friends of the Earth International, as I said before, we have been working on a system change agenda that means that we need to move away from the fossil fuels dependent economies and also to move away from the logic of capital accumulation through a just transition that puts at the center climate justice, but also the rights of workers, the rights of communities, the rights of indigenous peoples. It means to radically change our energy systems and building a 100% renewable energy system. But it's not only about technologies. It's also about who is controlling that energy system. It's about the need for public and community control, state-owned companies to control the energy system, in order for our societies to be able to answer the fundamental questions of how to produce energy, energy for what, for which purposes, for whom, must be answered democratically. And we also need to address the issue of energy poverty. We need to guarantee the right to energy for all, which is not the case today, where many people lack access to electricity. And this demands, of course, a very huge transfer of resources from the north to the south in order to pay for the climate debt and to pay for the historical crisis that has been generated mostly by the north and, of course, by certain classes within the north. We also need to have a class approach. But basically, it needs to build and reclaim justice. And this is our agenda in terms of the just transition. But we also need to change our food systems, both to address the climate and biodiversity crisis, but also the food crisis. And now we have, in the frame of this pandemic, a potential huge food crisis, where the relevance of local food systems and the importance of peasants' agroecology production system is becoming so evident, because we need to secure the right to food, which also needs the right to seeds, the rights to water, the right to land, but also the investment in this type of production systems that allow for the working class to access, to have the right to food, and also the development of local markets, the justice, based on justice, but also the development and the strengthening of public procurement systems that allow farmers and peasants to access to those markets, and also allow those who are more vulnerable to access to healthy food. We need to put forests in the hands of those communities and indigenous peoples who have been taking care of the forests historically and who have the knowledge systems and the governance systems to allow for community forest management and to really tackle deforestation. The problem we face now is that most of the forests in the world are not in the hands of indigenous peoples or local communities, but are being taken over by transnational corporations through land grabbing, territorial grabbing, also by the expansion of extractive activities like mining, fossil fuels operations, and so on. So we really need to reclaim the right of peoples to control their forests and to take decisions in terms of how to manage those forests. And this implies also resisting the imposition of false solutions that are coming through a neoliberal perspective, from a capitalist perspective, are coming to our territories, are being imposed in the name of the crisis. But we know that those false solutions that are about, you know, market mechanisms or systems for offsetting are not real solutions, because they do not work for the climate, but also they do not work for the people, and they do not they deny the rights of the peoples. They end up being, you know, very problematic and causing a lot of human rights abuses and denials. So we need to change the economy also. That was already very much explained by Richard. We need to have an economy that also integrates the feminist perspective of the economy, the importance of care work, but also of women autonomy, to reinforce and to strengthen the cooperative systems that are very, very important in many countries. We need, of course, tax justice. We need to stop tax avoidance and evasion. We need to make sure that we strengthen our public services. If we want to realize the rights of our peoples, public services must be strengthened. And of course, we also need to really reduce corporate or dismantle corporate power and impunity. And that means also reversing current free trade agreements and bilateral investment agreements, which rules really are set there to make sure that the corporations can profit from every crisis. And you know, these systems are also even used to reduce the policy space of countries. Even when countries have good policy proposals or policy being passed and implemented, they can be challenged in international tribunals through the investment state dispute settlement mechanism. So we really need to reverse that whole system, and we need to stop the current negotiations, free trade negotiations that are really threatening our rights and our economies and so on. We also, as I said before, we need to tackle the systems of oppression. We cannot allow for, you know, racism, class oppression, patriarchy, colonialism to continue to be imposed in our societies through various mechanisms, because this is so detrimental for all of us. So that's something that we need to really focus on. And we need to build people's power. We need to reclaim, as I said before, the political arena. But that means that we need to organize, and I agree with Richard, around a common project, a common agenda that allows us to converge as social movements around, you know, a common agenda that, you know, for change, for radical change. And we also need to build internationalist solidarity, because the attacks against democracy, against people's rights, against people, and really demands that internationalism becomes our, you know, strength, that we make sure that every struggle that takes place around the world is our own struggle. And that's what we are building as Friends of the Earth and also with allies, a system of internationalism that allows us to act, to take forward political action, to react every time community or people's organizations are being subject to persecution or, you know. Also, we have a very strong delegitimation campaign, a campaign to delegitimize social movements. And that's something that we need to be very careful about. It's taking place in many countries in Latin America. It's taking place in my country nowadays with a right-wing government, with a new right-wing government. And it really aims at silencing the voices of those who are struggling and those who are fighting for justice. So we cannot allow that to continue to happen, because there's a systematic attack, but also a very brutal and violent attack against those who are struggling for justice. And this is something that is becoming normalized in many countries. We see it in Brazil, we see it in Uruguay, we see in many countries how it's becoming normalized. And this is something that really, you know, it's coming to erode our most fundamental principles and humanity to change our social imaginary, but also is distracting the very basis of our societies. So internationalist solidarity, building people's power, dismantling the system of oppressions is a cross-cutting to all the changes we are promoting in terms of the of radically move away from this current capitalist fossil fuel dependent economy towards justice and towards people's sovereignty.
Great, that was really comprehensive. Thank you, Karen. I'm going to turn now to Sandra. Sandra is based in South Africa. She's a researcher who specializes in climate change and public services. She's worked for the Alternative Information and Development Center, AIDC, as well as for Public Services International Research Unit. That's the research unit of the Global Federation for Public Sector Workers. Sandra was the researcher for the 1 million climate jobs campaign, which was launched in South Africa in 2011. So Sandra, can you tell us a bit more about the million climate jobs campaign, what it called for, what progress has been made, what are the lessons for the Green New Deal movement?
Okay, thanks very much, Fiona. So I want to just start off, and I hope people can hear me better. I'll speak closer to the mic. I wanted to start off emphasizing what a dynamic Africa was in even before the pandemic. You know, country of enormous inequalities, one of the most unequal countries in the world, enormous backlog in housing, huge numbers of people simply don't have houses. They live in informal settlements, very close together, squashed very, very close together, lack access to water, electricity, sanitation. We have an incredibly high unemployment rate. It's close to 40%, which if you think about it in terms of the actual number of people who don't have jobs, that's nearly 10 million people, or it's about 10 million people that simply don't have jobs in the country. And all of these, obviously these criteria of the economic health of the country impact so much worse on women who bear the brunt of a lot of the needs that aren't being met. And even before the pandemic hit South Africa, we were facing a long-term stagnation of the economy. So as Fiona said, the Million Climate Jobs Campaign, or the 1 Million Climate Jobs Campaign, was launched in 2011. And it was about dealing with two crises, the crisis of unemployment. As I've said, it's a huge issue in South Africa. It's an issue of the structural nature of the South African economy, and the crisis of climate change. And it was saying, well, can we deal with both of these crises as part of the same campaign and call for the creation of climate jobs, which we saw as decent jobs, and we defined it broadly within the parameters of the ILO. And we said that these were public jobs, that these were that they should be publicly driven jobs. So the other important point to make about what we were trying to do is that we realized that the issue of unemployment wasn't just about creating jobs for those already unemployed. It was also about creating jobs for those that would, as we move to a low carbon economy, have to transition out of fossil fuel based jobs. And that would, you know, exacerbate the unemployment crisis even further. So what our research was about trying to do was quantify how many jobs could be created in all the different sectors of the economy. So for transport, if we talked about building safe, affordable, reliable, flexible, clean public transport system, you know, how many thousands of jobs could be created in that way? If we transition to a renewable energy system away from coal, how many climate jobs could that create? The same with local government and the built environment, retrofitting houses, ensuring that schools, hospitals, police stations were sustainable, were operating under energy efficient measures, etc. We have large numbers, as I've said, of people living in informal housing or in what is called RDP houses, which are reconstruction and development houses, which were built soon after the end of apartheid in the 1990s as part of beginning to try to meet the backlog of basic services that people had. But the houses were built, they often are built without ceilings. They often don't have, hot water. So, you know, you could imagine an enormous program spearheaded by local government to retrofit those houses with ceilings, with solar water heaters, with measures that could make the houses much more sustainable and viable for people to live in them. Then, of course, we also talked about agroecology and the need to shift away from these large commercialized farms, which contribute to climate change, to more sustainable agroecology, and also looking at the need for shifts in manufacturing and industry. You asked about some of the difficulties we faced in the campaign, and I want to some of the challenges, and I want to particularly focus on three. I think one of the biggest ones initially we found was that it was difficult for people to deal with something like climate change, which still seemed quite far, quite distant, when they had no house. They had no access to water. They had no access to electricity. You know, in that context, climate change can seem a very far and distant thing. And I think, you know, that's something to remember when we're moving forward, that we have to be addressing the basic needs of people, which in the country like South Africa are vast, or vast numbers of people don't have those basic needs. But I think as climate change has started to impact very clearly and directly on people's lives, you know, we've gone through a number of droughts. In fact, I think there's always a section of the country which is in drought. We've had load shedding, people, the temperature rising, etc., floods. As those have begun to impact directly on people's lives, I think we've been able to make the connection between food security and climate change, access to electricity and renewable energy, access to safe water resources, and so on. I think the other challenge that we came across was the way that renewable energy was introduced into South Africa. And I think this is an important lesson to draw out for talking about a vision for another way for, you know, an economy going forward. In South Africa, renewable energy was introduced through the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producers Program, which is basically a privatized renewable energy program. And there was massive opposition to this from the unions, who opposed privatization of renewable energy because of what the impact it has on jobs, on people's ability to afford electricity when it must be delivered for a profit, and so on. So that became quite a contentious issue. And I think the other, argument that we supported very strongly is that without introducing renewable energy through the public sector, we will not be able to introduce renewable energy at the scale and at the pace that is required to deal with climate change. So that fed into some work we've been doing around Eskom as a state-owned utility, where we're saying that what Eskom should be doing is moving away from being a predominantly coal-based generating power utility, and it should lead the transition to renewable energy rather than the private sector pushing the lead to renewable energy. And then the third area I wanted to talk about was, we emphasized very strongly, it's easy to fall into the trap of talking about climate change, of talking about the just transition as something that is just about, transitioning coal workers to renewable workers. And we said you have to see just transition as an economy-wide issue. You have to see dealing with climate change as an economy-wide issue, where we are looking to shift the entire economy to a low-carbon economy, so that we need a new industrialization path, an industrialization path which pushes manufacturing industry, which reduces our dependence on mining, etc. So that was another key aspect of what we were talking about. And I just wanted to pick up, I want to agree with what Richard said about re-looking at the trade agreements, because that came up also for us as a key issue, where if we're looking to build a renewable energy industry in South Africa, we're hampered by trade regulations which you know limit our ability to grow that industry. And then I wanted to just finish off. I've spoken about the Million Climate Jobs campaign, and I just wanted to finish off by talking about another campaign which links into the Million Climate Jobs campaign. And that is a campaign that emerged over the last year or so with a very evocative name. And the name of that campaign is The Cry of the Excluded. And it's a campaign which brings together unemployed people and trade unions. So the specific organizations include the Assembly of the Unemployed. It includes SAFTU, which is the South African Federation of Trade Unions. It includes AMCU, which is the the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union. And what this campaign is calling for is jobs, dignity, and services, which I think captures very sharply what we should be looking to as we move into calling for an economy which meets our needs during and post the pandemic. They talked about jobs in meeting basic needs, housing, early learning, food production, climate jobs, rural livelihoods. So very much a recognition of the need to look to protect livelihoods as well. So I think, you know, when we're talking about what we're struggling for, what we need to move on to, that takes into account all these different crises facing us, I think, you know, we certainly are drawing on those two campaigns as a way of framing how we see the way forward. And I think it's definitely, you know, linking back to my earlier point that I made in the introduction, that we definitely don't want to see just a reformed capitalism, a green capitalism. We need something that is far more fundamentally, structurally, and radically different. You know, something along the lines of eco-socialism. And I'll leave it there for now.
Great. Thank you very much, Sandra. I wondered whether we want to just look in a little more detail at the question of how do we build power as movements for climate justice. Karen, I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about your experience in Uruguay and Latin America in building power, both in terms of energy, but also in terms of people power. Uruguay is quite well known for its renewable energy transition, but there's also been criticism. So in what way do you see the transition as having been successful or not? And maybe you could tell us a little bit more about Latin America more generally, more broadly. And what lessons do you think that we need to learn to advance social and environmental justice in this moment?
So in Latin America, social movements are coming together, trade unions, feminist movement, peasant movement, environmental justice movements, also indigenous peoples, and it's not only Latin America, also throughout the Americas, to build an agenda that unites our struggles and an agenda that helps us advance our demands for justice in all its dimensions. And this means that we really need to tackle, as we were saying before, the neoliberal agenda. So that's one of the axes of our convergence space in Latin America, is to derail the neoliberal ideology, doctrine. And this is, as I said before, quite challenging nowadays, because in Latin America, in many countries, the neoliberal agenda is coming back, has come back, and even together with the right-wing agenda. So it's a horrible mixture of the two agendas. Of course, when we see how the capital through national corporations is making its way in our territories, we can see all the destruction that takes place, but also we see how human rights violations are taking place. And as I said before, also how people who are fighting against this very perverse system are being criminalized, persecuted, and even murdered. So democracy is clearly also under attack in Latin America, and that's the other axis of our struggle, is how we defend democracy, how we reclaim democracy, and how we strengthen democracy, which is not easy, again, because of current context. But this agenda that unites us allows us, for example, to discuss the just transition among environmental justice organizations, but also with unions, with feminist organizations and movements, and with peasant movement. And well, in fact, also TNI has been part of this debate and these discussions and this process. And this is an agenda that means, like Sandra was saying, that goes well beyond the change of technologies. And it has a lot to do with who is in control of the energy system and how it relates to the economy that we want to rebuild and we want to shape. But it's also very, very important the how public services are strengthening, how we make sure that there's a strong investment funding from the public sphere, public funding, in order to strengthen those that transition that we urgently need. We believe that this unity of the movements is vital in order to build power. And in that sense, the how we come together is as important as the end, you know, objective. It's not only about meeting certain objectives, but it's also how we get organized, how we come together, and how we have the right processes. Because it is true that we are coming from different walks of lives. Although many of us have been fighting, you know, against the oppressive forces in the continent, there's a history of also unity against dictatorships in Latin America and in South America. And this is very relevant for my country, in fact, where the trade unions have this strong unity that allows for the unity of the left and for the unity of the struggle against, you know, oppression and oppressive forces. And it was very key, really, to defeat the dictatorship in the past. So that's what we are, you know, building. That is our agenda, mainly, in terms of building people's power. But the context does not help. In the case of Uruguay, we are now coming together again in the context of this pandemic with many social movements, including the feminist movement, but very relevant, of course, the Trade Unions Confederation, which is very strong in my country, PIT-CNT, and also the housing cooperative movements, student movements, many, many movements coming together to have a common agenda of what is needed, you know, in this crucial, you know, situation. The government, on the contrary, the new right-wing neoliberal government that got into office on March, is, you know, pushing for another agenda, an agenda that is about, you know, liberalization of the economy, weakening public services, opening, you know, even more for liberalization of investments in land. So it's all the opposite that what should happen, and it's really a very regressive agenda. It's a lot about austerity measures also. So there's a very, very strong fight taking place here. In relation to the changes in the energy system, which were very important indeed, they were possible because we had a very strong public utility, energy utility, because we have this state-owned enterprise that is UTE, that was able to, you know, to lead this change towards the a new energy matrix. So we have today a very strong wind power system. We also have photovoltaic energy, and this means that the renewable matrix is very strong, with almost 40% in the case of wind energy for electricity. As I said before, UTE is a very key player in this system, but also the fact that there was a policy public policy design to change the matrix, the energy matrix, was also very important. It was not led to the market. It was really a policy conceived and designed to allow for this radical change. The problem we face, I think, in Latin America, and that's also what the unions are saying, is that the neoliberal frameworks from the 90s are an obstacle to the changes in the energy systems, in the energy matrix in Latin America, because we still have these neoliberal regulation frameworks for the energy sector that were passed through in the 90s during the neoliberal decade. And they are an obstacle because they do open to liberalization of energy. They did open to privatization of energy. In many countries, that was, you know, reversed through the progressive and left-wing governments, but still it's a big challenge. And that means that in Uruguay, for example, a generation is also in the hands of private companies, although transmission and distribution is solely in the hands of the state-owned company. But the state-owned company has agreements, power purchase agreements for 20 years with private companies, in which it means that the state-owned company is obliged to pay for the energy that is generated, even if it doesn't need it. It is obliged to buy it, even if it doesn't need it. And this is something that, of course, us and the trade unions have been questioning. But adding to that, also these power purchase agreements are also backed when they are multinational companies, you know, generating electricity. The agreements are backed by bilateral investment treaties. So the threat of potential demands against the country, if the country decides to change, you know, its policies, or it decides to not to pay the price of energy that, you know, has been committed because of the changes that are taking place, then the country can be subject to international demands in these tribunals. And this is something that is happening in Latin America. Many of the demands in international tribunals are around energy, electricity, and had to do also with public services. Well, one of the demands, for example, in Colombia is one company from Spain demanding the state, and the fact that the truth is that the company was not really fulfilling the service that was supposed to give, as always. But the company, demanded the state of Colombia because of the intervention of the state to guarantee the service in part of the Colombian territory. So this is one of the challenges we also see, and that's why we say that both the neoliberal frameworks for energy and electricity, and the free trade agreements and bilateral investment agreements are an obstacle for the changes we want to make in terms of a just transition. Because again, like it was said before, it is very important that the public sector plays a key role. In Friends of the Earth, there's also a lot of experience in community-owned energy and controlled energy, which is also very important. So the combination of the two, of the public services, the public generation, the public control energy utilities, state-owned energy utilities, and community energy, we think that is the path for a just transition. And also for the generation of jobs that Sandra was referring to, and to make sure that the rights of workers, communities, and climate justice are at the center. And this implies, of course, a lot of also public finance. And that's something we consider that the state should, you know, put as a priority, you know, how to invest more in public services. And that's, you know, something that all the movements in Latin America are really calling for. So we really need to reverse the neoliberal agenda. The context is very difficult now, but we will keep, of course, fighting and coming together and being united around that struggle. So.
Great. Thank you very much, Karen. Sandra, it sounds like a very familiar story, I think, that Karen's told about Latin America. I hear resonance with South Africa. Sandra, what do you see as the way forward in South Africa coming out of the pandemic and for addressing future crises?
Well, if I was better and cleverer with words, and if I was to try and develop an alternative to that phrase New Green Deal, I would say that what we should be doing is having a campaign of the cry of the excluded for an extreme solution. So I think, you know, we really do need to look at extreme solutions that actually take into account the extent to which this pandemic has completely devastated, you know, people were hanging on by their fingernails before, and I think now, you know, pretty much everything's been lost. And I think it's important that we note that it's capitalism that has been generating and driving these crises that we're facing, the climate change, the pandemics, pollution, and that it's inadequate governmental responses to these crises, also because of capitalism. So cuts in health spending, inadequate spending on housing, sanitation, water, electricity. So I think that really just for me re-emphasizes the need for us to move away from this neoliberal mindset that I think Karen was referring to, and that is so also prevalent in South Africa, even in the response of the government, the economic response of the government to the pandemic. They took an important health step in locking down the country, but they didn't meet it with a concomitant economic radical step, which could actually allow people to survive without the informal economy that so many people have survived on. So I think if we're talking about, you know, a kind of a program or a vision of what we want moving forward, I think it obviously has to be a major focus on health and safety. And I think, you know, it's an important point to make is that health and safety has been a problem for workers, for communities living next to coal mines, coal generating power stations, for decades. You know, various organizations have tried to raise it and tried to deal with it, but it's largely been ignored. And I think this pandemic is an opportunity to say workers shouldn't go back to work unless the conditions are safe, but they shouldn't just be safe from COVID-19. They should be safe conditions and healthy conditions to live in for any health issue or illness or disease. So I think that's sort of health and safety for me is a major issue. I think job creation through public sector employment, a basic income grant, which actually allows people to not just barely survive, but actually live. A public health system, which can meet the challenge of COVID-19 and subsequent pandemics and diseases that we're going to get in the future. A solution that deals with the spatial problems that exist in South Africa, where we still live very much with the legacy of apartheid and the spatial inequalities that is created, the lack of housing that builds houses that are sustainable, as I mentioned earlier, that institutes land reform that deals with food poverty, food insecurity, and gives farmers and workers better opportunities to survive on the land, that takes account of the particular position of women and the challenges that all of these issues create for women and the kind of traditional role that women bear and what that means for them. The, you know, public transport, proper sanitation services, you know, I could go on. There's a whole important list of very vital services that need to be provided. And so I want to, you know, then link it to what Richard was saying right at the beginning about the need to, you know, when we talk about, okay, well, how are we going to finance this? I think the pandemic threw out of the window, as Richard said, the whole idea that governments can't afford to spend money on social services. Clearly, when they need it, government has the money. And I think we need to really take that to heart when we move forward. But I think more concretely, we need to look at tax issues. We need to fight for tax justice and end to tax havens. We need to deal decisively with illicit financial flows as well as legal capital flights out of countries. We need to look at the issue of debt and the debt that countries are facing. Work we've been doing on Eskom and the kind of debt that it has run up. We're talking about the need to focus on something like odious debt and say, well, how much of this debt should actually be paid back? And yeah, so I think in taking forward this work, it's going to require organizing across trade unions, workplaces, communities, you know, from the formally employed to the precariously employed to the informally, you know, workers to those who are, you know, surviving through their livelihoods. And we need to be able to build a coalition of all these groups. And I think that is the only way that we're actually going to be able to take anything forward. And I think then we need to be looking at how to build the links between what is happening in, you know, South Africa, other African countries, Latin American countries, and build a kind of an international solidarity that can build a better world. So, yeah.
Great. Thanks, Sandra. We're going to run out of time, and we have lots of questions on the Q&A. So we've got a team who's been filtering and merging and trying to help us collect some questions that that we can ask the panel to address. One of them comes from the Institute for Political Ecology that is co-sponsoring this event. And the question, which I'm going to put to Richard, first, is how would we ensure that any global new Green New Deal question keeps economic activities within ecological limits? And are there lessons that come out of this pandemic for how we can do this or not do this? Richard, would you like to address Appy's question? Richard muted again.
I just think you've got to be a little bit careful about blaming neoliberalism for everything. I mean, the suffering of the developing world right now is not due to lockdown and shutdown is not a neoliberal agenda. If anything, it's the opposite of a neoliberal agenda, but it still exposes the vulnerability of developing countries to external shocks. And that vulnerability and some of the things that Sandra talked about, I think is critical, including governments that have in the South that have bought into neoliberalism are now being hit harder than anybody else as a consequence of buying that medicine. But it also is a reminder that advanced economies, when they, even as they preach this kind of agenda to developing countries, when it's not in their interest, they will drop it at a pinch. I think we will get a real example of the kind of hypocrisy of many advanced country governments when it comes to dealing with this crisis. And, you know, you can see it already in the WTO as they dole out massive subsidies to their own corporations to keep them afloat. They will be arguing that developing countries should not be allowed to use subsidies in their day-to-day struggles to build up the kinds of industries that they need to tackle the multiple problems that we've talked about today. So I think, yeah, I think dealing with that hypocrisy of the advanced economies is going to be a big issue coming out of the crisis. In terms of what the COVID-19 challenge does remind us of and speaks to the issue directly of ecology is how we deliver public goods and protect the public and the global commons is a central part of any sort of progressive agenda, and I think a lot of people like to talk about global public goods and the provision of global public goods. Of course, you know, we don't live in a world of global government, and I think thankfully so, in my opinion. But, you know, the difficulty of providing global public goods in the absence of global government, and that governments are responsible for public goods at the national level, is, you know, it's an old challenge that has haunted the multilateral system since its inception, really. And finding more democratic mechanisms at the international level more representative mechanisms at the international level to deal with these problems, to deal with the problems of policy coordination, of dealing with the problems of international taxation, dealing with the problems of illicit financial and licit financial flows that make the lives of developing country policymakers all the more difficult. That is a huge challenge. I think how we think about that notion of representation at the international level really still has not been addressed. All we can say is that the current institutions really do not show the kind of degree of representation that is necessary to deal with certainly the problems that most policymakers in the developing world face on a daily, on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you, Richard. Sorry, I lost my unmute button for a minute. I wanted to ask Karen and Sandra if they would very shortly respond to the same question and to Richard's comments. Perhaps Karen, we'll start with you.
Okay, thanks. So yes, definitely we need to go for a system change agenda that allows us to live within the ecological limits. And that is because both the global impacts of this current system, as we said, the biodiversity crisis, climate crisis, which has a global dimension, but also because the environments and the territories and livelihoods of peoples at the local level. So it's the combination of the two. We need to consider the global impacts of current production systems and current modes of production, but also we need to look at the local implications and the implications for the rights of the peoples. And that is very clear when we look at the energy system, how, you know, the development of infrastructure for dirty energy projects, for example, means massive land grabbing, it means destruction of forests, it means contamination of the water, it means, you know, destruction of livelihoods. So it's really a massive violation of very fundamental rights, but also it means that the systems that allow the systems and functions that allow, you know, for life to exist are under, you know, huge pressure and are, you know, being threatened. So both for global reasons, but also for local reasons and for people's rights is that we really need to live within the limits of the planet. Having said that, the justice dimension is key. So it's not just to say within the limits, but how that space is distributed and shared has been one of the main problems. If we look at the climate crisis, it's clear that those who have generated the crisis are mostly in a very small portion of the population and are very few countries that historically are responsible for generating the crisis, while those who are most affected in the South are the ones that have not contributed to the crisis. So the ecological limits must go hand in hand with the issue of justice in all its dimensions. Again, it's also about gender justice, it's about economic justice, social justice, and environmental justice. And this is, should be the basis of any new system or the transformation of our systems needs to be the basis for that. And we can make few changes if we, as we have been saying, for example, if we further develop food sovereignty and agroecology, if we go for community forest management and so on, we can live within the limits from a justice perspective, and this has to happen also with the energy system, and this is something that is very urgent indeed.
Sandra, do you have something to say on what Richard had said in the question about, it's effectively about staying within the ecological limits, and there's lots of questions on the chat about the question of degrowth.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would follow on from what Karen has been saying, because I think, you know, you can't talk about the ecological limitations without talking about redistribution of resources. And when we, you know, live in, when you start talking about ecological limitations, when you are, still have this hugely unequal world where, you know, the wealthy are extremely wealthy and the poor are extremely poor, then too often I fear it's the poor that are going to find themselves suffering because they cannot access electricity, basic housing, etc., because, you know, because of these ecological limitations. So I think if you need to look at a massive redistribution across the globe and within countries in order to redistribute wealth. And I think, you know, some of the ecological questions, if you were able to do that like quite radically, I think some of the ecological questions could be addressed in that way. And I think, you know, I think particularly for us in South Africa, when so many people don't have electricity, we can't talk about, and we face load shedding, we can't talk about limiting or cutting back on the amount of electricity being generated, because that'll mean that thousands of people just simply will never have electricity, will never have access. They'll never be able to, you know, they'll continue to exist in this kind of poverty ridden environment. So yeah, I think that's what I would want to contribute there.
Good.
I mean, it shouldn't be framed as, I mean, degrowth, you know, it's not a credible argument for our constituency. You're not going to sell degrowth to developing country policymakers in a million years. So to think of it in those terms, I don't think is necessarily helpful. I mean, redistribution is critical, but we've seen the developed countries can't even meet their paltry 0.7% aid targets, let alone take it seriously. So, you know, growth is inevitable in the South. The question is, can you do growth in a way that does not repeat the mistakes of the advanced economies? I think Sandra's point, you know, Italy is an economy that has experienced degrowth now for two decades. I don't think it's a model that I would want to extend to the rest of the developing world, because underneath that degrowth experience in Italy is a set of the rules of the game that have undermined public services and bred fascism. So it's not the kind of model that you, just talking about degrowth independently of the rules of the game and the structures and the institutions around which wealth is created and distributed is meaningless almost, unfortunately. And I think civil society needs to kind of get beyond the growth versus degrowth argument if it's going to come up with a serious agenda that can convince policymakers in both the North and the South, actually.
Thank you, Richard. I think the whole debate around growth, degrowth will be the subject of a whole other discussion. I think it's quite a complex debate, especially when you're trying to conduct this at a global level. We don't have much time left, and I hope that the questions that I've seen coming through on the Q&A have been more or less addressed in the course of the discussion and the inputs of Richard, Karen, and Sandra. We have one surprise guest online who very kindly agreed to join us and has been waiting patiently. When we heard that Assad wasn't able to make it. And that's David Adler. And David is the organizer for the Progressive International that was launched on Monday and caused quite a buzz, I think, around the world. So we thought we'd ask David to just talk very briefly, David, because we are running out of time and I haven't been the best chairperson for this session. Just tell us a bit about the PI for those who haven't yet heard about it. And how people can get involved if they want to. And thank you very much for being here.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me, Fiona. It's been a, you know, excellent discussion to tune into. And I feel very lucky because I don't actually have to cover very much substance, because I think the motivation for this project has been spelled out in great detail by the panelists so far, which is that, you know, the recognition, obviously the framing of this event is fundamentally the recognition that the crises that we're facing are global, as are the networks of distribution, as well as learning that's happening at the municipal level. So, you know, Sandra was just talking about the importance of kind of linking together these movements into some kind of, I think you used the phrase coalition. So that's, you know, we come to that with that premise where, you know, progressive forces, broadly speaking, are far less well organized than our neo-fascist challengers, who are organizing in something like a nationalist international, as well as the neoliberal set that organizes very openly at Davos every year. And maybe the distance between those two is the daylight is closing between them. But that we, I think the premise is the idea that we really lack some of the fundamental infrastructure for internationalism. And there's so much, you know, what I think you spoke about the response we've had since Monday, and it's been very positive, I think, because there's a lot of appetite for some kind of vehicle for international solidarity. We've been stuck in a kind of position where solidarity really is very not much more than a slogan. And, you know, Bolsonaro gets elected in Brazil, and what do? We take to our Twitters and we say, we stand in solidarity with the people of Brazil, because that's, we don't have very much else that we can do, because a lot of the, you know, and of course there's many existing efforts. The last thing we want to do in the presentation of this progressive international with the few groups that we've convened already is pretend that we're reinventing the wheel and there are not other groups who are doing this work. But I think there's a sense in which a thousand flowers, especially at this juncture, have to bloom. And so the idea is that we want to help build that infrastructure and help build that coalition Sandra was mentioning. You know, UNCTAD has been doing God's work, but if we can connect some of those ideas with social movements around the world, you know, building on the successes and failures of something like World Social Forum in years past, then that would be fantastic. Now, I think just by way of explaining how we're thinking about the membership in this progressive international, I think the idea is that, you know, past internationals focus primarily on political parties. That's the premise of the Socialist International, for example. And there are many networks that link together in federation form, trade unions also. But the goal of this progressive international is really to match where we are in the 21st century, where you may have a lot more loyalty to your local, you know, rag newspaper, workers' rag newspaper, than you do to your political party that would have frayed and cartelized over the past 30 years. You may have a much closer relationship to your local social movement that's helping to organize, or your tenant organization, than you would to your trade union. I mean, I speak here as a millennial. So many of us are not unionized. You know, so we see it as essential that all these different types of organizations that we're, well, you know, we're welcoming that associational pluralism into this international. So there's individuals, you know, many of whom will not have an organizational affiliation that are welcoming that international, as well as organizations of all those stripes. And we bring a kind of communist mentality into it of saying, you know, each of those organizations, from their ability, they'll be able to contribute something. You know, Karen spoke a lot about all the stuff that we're learning at local levels about, you know, how to, forgive me if we call them best practices, but transmitting the lessons around the world. Some parts of the world really good at WhatsApp organizing, others less so. Some municipal governments really know how to, you know, regulate their rental markets. Others have less experience in doing that. So if we can facilitate the best practices at the local level, as well as, you know, more effectively train the progressive imagination at the international level, I think, you know, this is less true of the people who've convened here who have a real appetite for this, but I think progressives generally tend to play a bit of peekaboo politics, where if we just don't talk about the IMF, it's not there. I'm sure, Richard, you share this frustration where, you know, it's really tough to get national political parties to care. Now, if there's a silver lining, I think, of the present pandemic, it's to repoliticize many of these institutions. You will have seen a petition that came out just today, signed by 300 lawmakers around the world, saying, you know, okay, we call for debt cancellation. But sitting parliamentarians, you know, that's the 20th century way of organizing our political action, and we've got to welcome a much broader coalition of forces. So that's what we're hoping to do in the context of this progressive international. This is step zero. And I hope that, you know, the people we've convened so far they're just to get us out the door and speak from the position that they have and help us think through some of these questions. But this is fundamentally a membership-based initiative. They are to serve members, to work with them, and engage in a big listening exercise about how that international infrastructure can be useful to these different groups around the world. So that's the proposition. And of course, we'll be building this over the days and weeks to come. And, you know, I'm really excited to have the opportunity to, I guess, pitch it, you might say, but to welcome all the people who might be listening and viewing this to say, please come in and get in touch with me, even personally, so we can have a conversation about how this thing can be really useful. Because the last thing we need is just another, you know, pat on the back petition or some kind of, you know, group of armchair, as much as I love the armchair intellectuals, another group of kind of armchair thinking that isn't doing that work of braiding together those movements. And then once we have that kind of united front, actually mobilizing and getting on the streets and creating change in our communities around the world. Sorry for taking too much time there. I appreciate the opportunity towards the end of this. Thank you.
No, that's great. That's great, David. Thank you. I think we're coming to the end of our time now, unfortunately. So I want to say a very big thanks to Richard, to Karen, Sandra, and David for being on our panel today. Also thanks to our co-sponsors, that's Folks on the Global South, AIDC, the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation, Transform Europe, and the Institute for Political Ecology in Croatia. If you want to stay involved in discussions on the Green New Deal, then we are co-sponsoring a series organized by the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation and Transform Europe. And its next event is on the 21st of May on trade policy. Well, the trade policy needed for a Green New Deal. So we put some links in the chat if you want more detail there. And then TNI will continue its Wednesday series at 4 o'clock. Our next webinar is called The Public is Back, and it's co-organized with Public Services International, which is the trade union confederation of public sector workers worldwide, representing 700 trade unions around the world. And this webinar will look at how we can build democratically accountable, climate-conscious, worker-driven public services for all, financed by taxing the excessively wealthy. You can register for that now with the link in the chat. And then the webinar thereafter will be on the 27th, and we're organizing that with AWID, and it will be on feminist responses to the crisis. And we will be running the COVID capitalism webinars throughout June. And we're going to be looking at all kinds of themes, including decarceration, borders, technology and data, and the popular uprisings in North Africa are some of the subjects that are on the agenda. Not part of our Wednesday series, but we wanted to take the opportunity to announce it, is that on Saturday at 7:20 p.m. Central European time, we have another event that we're doing with other organizations entitled The Future Beyond Shell. So there'll be activists and artists from around the world trying to imagine a future without Shell and big oil. And again, the link is in the chat if you'd like to join that. To make sure you don't miss future events and to receive links to all the recordings of our webinars, please do subscribe to our newsletter. And if you found today's session useful, please also consider donating to TNI via our website. It really helps us cover some of the costs associated with organizing this series. And we really do need financial support for this work, so we appreciate anything you're able to give. Thank you again for joining us. And we are going to leave the chat open now for about 5 more minutes so that people have a chance to say goodbye, wrap up conversations, and so forth. So many thanks again. Big thanks to our panel, our co-sponsors, and to the translators and the team that's been working behind the scenes. Thanks a lot. Bye. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.